I'll Drink to That, where we get into wine one person at a time. I'm your host, Levy Dalton. The show warm-ups are provided by Aaron Scala, and together we go behind the scenes of the beverage business.
It was a beautiful February day in 1956. The temperature in Provence hovered just below 70 degrees. Far away, newspapers had reported wonky weather in the southern hemisphere during their winter several months earlier. In Brazil, for instance, it was astonishing to learn that Sao Paulo recorded their lowest ever temperature, 28.22 degrees Fahrenheit, in a place where the temperature almost never goes below 50. Lunchtime in Provence, though, was business as usual. Most people going about their day wouldn't have been able to imagine the destruction that would occur over the next 24 hours. A massive cold front was on its way from the North Pole, and this, coupled with an unusual set of pressure systems, was about to create a once-in-a-lifetime weather anomaly. On February 4, 1956, the Chicago Tribune reports a rising death toll across Europe as cold fronts from Russia caused major damage. The article paints a very real picture.
Fresh blasts from Siberia swept towards Western Europe tonight to continue the cold wave that has cost more than 100 lives. From behind the Iron Curtain came hints of a disastrous fuel shortage in the continent's worst winter of the century. Poland's government called for talks on how to save coal and ordered bonuses to boost output from the mines. At least 102 persons are dead. Paris had its coldest February 2nd in 75 years when the temperature dropped to 5 above zero. Thames River frozen over for the first time in 10 years. In London, garbage has not been collected in 10 days. A helicopter flitted over lakes in Suffolk and freed swans trapped by ice. Two Britons swam in the sea at Yarmouth. They said it was warmer in the water than out of it. Frost ruined fields of spring flowers on the Riviera, and growers estimated their loss at $1.5 million. This cold system, and subsequent ones after it, would go on to slam Italy with snow. Roofs collapsed, animals starved, citrus orchards died, travelers were stranded, infrastructure broke down, and dozens of avalanches wreaked pure havoc. In some places along the Mediterranean, the massive snowdrifts didn't melt until June. What triggered the crazy weather? Some guess that the odd 1955 Southern Hemisphere winter and the freezing 1956 Northern Hemisphere temperatures were a mini nuclear winter, resulting from the many nuclear tests that had taken place the year before. Others posit that the sun's unusual display of sunspots that year may have triggered the weather. Whatever the reason, that night in Provence, temperatures plunged to about 2 degrees. Those who could listen through their walls reported terrifying sounds from outdoors. The sound of orchards making crying noises as olive trees creaked and swelled. Then ominous snapping sounds as the branches burst open when their sap froze and expanded. At the end of the freeze, 2/3 of Provençal olive trees were gone. Some of them had been standing over 800 years. Many of those who experienced the olive tree losses replanted with grapevines. Grapevines can give you a harvest in a few years, but olive trees would take 5 to 12 years to produce their first crop. This choice would steer the region towards a heavier wine-based economy. Farther north, wine regions were also hit hard by devastating frosts. European vineyards had just recovered from phylloxera, and they had set the course for their new directions. But the 1956 frosts changed all that. Cahors in particular was brought to its knees. Nearby in Bordeaux, the frost killed so many vines that subregions actually had the opportunity to reinvent themselves. In Pomerol, for instance, before the frost, Cabernet Franc was popular throughout the area. But after the frost, most people replanted with Merlot, possibly in the hopes of getting some higher yields after the failed 56 vintage. To give you an example, Petrus lost 2/3 of their vineyards. It took years for the right bank producers to recover from the 1956 losses, and when the region came out of it, Pomerol was quite different, namely in that Merlot made up more of the blends. Keep listening to hear more from one producer who has cast a heavy lot in Pomerol Merlot.
I'm Michelle Basilia, wine director of Blue Hill, New York City.
Lee Campbell from Diner in Brooklyn.
This is Sharon Severins from Amonti Vino in Montclair, New Jersey.
Patrick Capiello, Rebel in Pearl and Ash.
Ian Doran from the Wine Library.
Jeremy Noy, Morel Fine Wine Retail and Wine Bar at Rockefeller Center.
These tri-state buyers all know that 750 is a one-stop resource for the beverage alcohol trade. Search across distributor portfolios, see trade tastings, and easily connect with your sales rep. It's free and easy to sign up. Go to 750.com, spelled out, for more information. 1947 Vieux Chateau Sertan is one of the best wines I've ever had in my entire life. I've drunk a large number of astounding wines in my day, and frankly, it's hard to single out particular bottles. But I had the 1947 VCC in 2004, and the way I figure it, if you're still clearly remembering a wine over a decade after you've had it, you're probably pretty fond of it. Anyway, I was talking to Alexander Tempo, who is in charge of VCC today, and I shared with him how much I love the 1947 vintage of VCC. He told me that if that was the case, I should really try the 1945 because it's the better wine. That was good for me to know, but more I was impressed by how familiar he is with vintages that happened 40 years before he even started running the winery in 1985. And even that was 30 years ago. So he's pretty fluent with vintages that were 70 years old, which is pretty incredible and speaks to how it's different when your family has been running the same winery for generations. You get to try wines with your dad and your grandfather, wines that they made, and you get to do it regularly and with your family, which is a different kind of connection than anyone else can really kind of hope for ever. The Tempo family has owned VCC since the early 1920s, and Alexander's dad was the winemaker from 1966 up until Alexander in 85. But even more astounding in terms of timeline is that this is a property that goes back to the 18th century as an estate. That's a long time back. In fact, this is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, of Pomerol wine properties. The Tempo family controls VCC today, but they also have a range of other wine interests, including a consultancy business with small producers in Bordeaux, a wine trading business called Wings, which is headed up by Alexander's cousin Francois, and which sells Bordeaux wines. And famously, the Tempo family also owns Le Pin, the Pomerol property which they purchased in 1979, and which is often cited as one of Bordeaux's most expensive wines in the secondary market, and just very hard to find as well. Contrasting with the long history of VCC, Le Pin is much more recent and went from total obscurity to a huge amount of fame in the 1980s with a lot of demand. Here is Francois Tempo describing that shift in the market for Le Pin back at the same time that he was living and working in the United States.
Oh, it was in 1981. So for me, it was a great opportunity because it was the booming city at that time. And I had an opportunity to sell wines and cheeses. I had a cheese shop with an English guy, and we...
Well, a different world for
different
you,
huh? World, yes. And for me, it's exactly the time when I make my connection, which I use all those friends today, you know. Can be a journalist or wine distributors. For me, it was really the start of my business, you know, especially in the U.S. For instance, the fact I was in Houston, Texas, when the family bought Le Pin in 1979, and the first vintage which I really imported was the 1981. And at that time, nobody wanted Le Pin because my uncles wanted. It was such a small quantity that they decided to sell the wine at the same price than Vieux Chateau Sertan. And you have to think at that time, 80s, people, you know, the wine is not like it is today. And why buy an unknown Pomerol, same price than the famous Vieux Chateau Sertan? So it was kind of insane. So,
but not for long, right?
Not for long, but it took a while. I bought one third of the crop and imported here, a vintage 1981, and sold to... different retailers all over the countries, and they just saw my face and my name and trust me. They didn't see the bottle, they didn't see the label, they didn't taste the wine. They just get the price. Well, the price is pretty expensive, but you know, can have five cases there. Why not, you know? And then it just happened that I knew the one journalist of the Washington Post at that time. Bob Thompson was a good friend of mine. And they invited me for a weekend. And so and just received by shipment Le Pain 1881. So I just put a bottle in my luggage and flew to Washington, D.C. And he said, oh, I have tonight some friends for dinner. And one of them, who was his friend, lawyer, his name was Robert Parker. Then he tested that. He didn't know at all. He asked me, where can I find this wine? I told him, oh, you can find in Washington, D.C. at Ed Sands, New York in Park Avenue, and so on, different places. So then he started to buy some bottles. And then he wrote about, and the rest is...
Became quite a big thing.
Yes, yes. He really, and I have to say that in 81, Le Pain was really the first great vintage of Le Pain. And then came, of course, the 82, which he gave a 100 point. And then the rest was...
Because I think a lot of times people don't think of 81 as a strong vintage in general. Do you think it surprised them, the quality of the wine for the vintage? Do you think that was part of the surprise?
Yes, also because the style of the wine was really quite unique. The silkiness, extremely lush, seductive, exotic. So it was very easy for especially American palate, you know, said, wow, what is this? You know, that's a big deal. I mean, we love it. And I think I got this because the fact I was not in Bordeaux, I was abroad and taste the wine here. As a matter of fact, I first taste the 81 Le Pain with the ex-sommelier of La Tour d'Argent who just moved on in Houston. So it just happened that we shared the bottle and we drank the bottle. I said, wow, this is good. And so I bought it. And so the fact to be outside of your own land, you know, you have give you another perspective. I was, of course, not, I have no clue that this one will become an icon, you know, because, you know, it was tough to sell. And one of the journalists in Houston, as a matter of fact, Houston Chronicle, just wrote that, yes, this Le Pain, it's okay for a generic Pomerol. So he was not so... Anyway, but then the wine sold very well.
Till today. Since,
yeah, oh yes, of course, now it's a...
Do you think it's a wine that was really driven by the United States market, or was there other markets that were equally or more interested?
The U.S. market was leader, and then, of course, the English market came. The fact that Parker started to write about, and then after some others came after that, and so created a big deal, you know.
And what about the market for Vieux Château Sertan? Is that a different market than Le Pain?
Yes. Vieux Château Sertan at that time was a classic, very respected name. And we are not, obviously, Alexandre will talk about, of course, more deeply, but we have, it was such a big difference today work compared to his father's work, for instance. It's, I would say, days and night. So it's not at all the same thing.
So, for François Tempot, the winemaking at VCC has definitely changed since his cousin Alexander took over that property and the winemaking there in 1985. But how has it changed? I asked Alexander to clarify which winemaking changes have gone on since he started.
One thing is that we use not recipes, but methods. That's the most important. That's a very... And we are talking about quality of wine and not at all about prices of the wine. So I'm living every day in a true luxury. We are surrounded by false luxury everywhere, cars, watches and everything. But I'm very lucky. Every day when I open my shutters, I'm right immersed in the vineyard. So I'm in front of a vineyard which is made up with the different plots from the youngest were planted in 2010 and the oldest in 1932, for example. So the aim is to make the best wine as possible for a given year. And that is a glass of wine of VCC is always what is the link, the closer link to what nature gives a certain year. So the methods used at VCC, they are changing every day. We are immersed in the vineyard, so we have to decide one day after the other, the nose in the handlebar, which will be the best for the next day, the next week. It's always custom made. And what is a good wine? That's the most important. A good wine is the contrary of a simple wine. Complexity is the question. So the method you use to have this kind of complexity given by the soil, given by different varieties, given by different kind of refraction of the soil, etc., and methods used. So altogether, the aim is to have the wine the more complex as possible in a way that you have finesse, complexity, length, and all the rest. And you have this for different plots. You can have plots prone to be better in tannin, for example, and plots better for perfume, and the other ones, other variety, much better for length, for example, for Cap Franc, especially. The landscape, the vineyard around, is like a patchwork of different specificities.
So each of those parcels probably demands a little bit of a different kind of management.
The 14 hectares of vineyard of VCC and the 2.5 hectares of Le Pin are all divided for VCC in 23 different plots. And now we are looking inside the different plots with the GPS system and all the new methods given by the new generation to have an idea of the production of each different plant. So for 2015, it was the real first time we decided to stop the pickers with a GPS system in hand. What happened? That the precision is much higher. As a result, the best batches are even better, and the low quality ones are even worse. The difference between the batches is much more important. So you can, it's like a pyramid, and the quality of the wine is much better now than it used to be. Of course, that's the big lesson for that.
And when did you arrive at VCC?
I took over the property when my father died. It was at the end of 85, 30 years ago. 2015 is my 30 years vintage there.
That's quite a long time, I mean.
A long time.
In winemaker terms, it's a while. And you probably have a lot of experience of different vintages from also before your career and then obviously with your career.
Yeah, because I remember tasting we made with my father in 1972, about five different 1950s, and it was a blind tasting. And my father said, don't forget the price of the wines. Just see through the wine the real value of them. It was VCC, of course. Certain de Mai, just behind. Petrus, Lafleur, and Cheval Blanc. And at the end of the tasting, which one was the best? At the low price. It was Certain de Mai was the best, 1950. Second, I have to confess that, it was VCC, and then all the rest. But you see, a tasting of 1950 in 72 is exactly as if we made the same blind tasting for 1986 for today, for example. So it's not so far. And for me, it remains that 1950 is the example to do for good wine. It's 2010, for example.
For you, the 1950 and the 2010 have a similarity.
Exactly. They are twins. As 2009 is a twin with 1948. 1948 is Glass of Silk. And 2009 is a Glass of Silk too. 2010, shortly speaking, is a Glass of Velvet. In 1950, it's a Glass of Velvet, yeah.
And what other twins do you see?
Difficult to say. For example, 2014, I was asked a long time, and I have no comparison at all. 2014 is itself 2014, is quite, which will be, I think, the same for 2015. Because 2015 is, in a way, 2009, but with very good Cap Franc, which is not the case for 2009. 2009, the Cap Franc were stuck by an excess of drought.
So you have been, since your father's time, tasting a number of different properties on the right bank and in Pomerol. And how would you say that your understanding of VCC compares to those? How do you think the VCC expression compares or contrasts with the neighbors?
It's a good question, in a way, that I still always manage to make the wine at VCC with the aim to make the wine closer to what nature gives. Technology behind the scenes at VCC is the highest you can expect, but it always in case of. So if you don't have any technology in your cellar, the margin of security between wine and vinegar is very thick. If you have a big technology behind the scenes, And also, in the opposite, if you use technology to make a wine, natural wine, you rub the character, you rub the signature, you rub the soul of the wine. So the wine made from the beginning, when I started VCC until now, is the more natural you can expect, but with a very, very narrow thickness of security. So in that way, VCC is always, in blind tasting, you can recognize it very easily because it has its own character, its own signature. It's Cap Franc. It's mainly Cap Franc, a sign with that. And in a blind tasting, Petrus, for example, is 100% Merlot or something like this. It's quite easy to find out. VCC, two-thirds, one-third is very easy. Cheval Blanc also is. You see, all the different properties at this standard of quality are more and more recognized.
You can recognize it.
Recognize it, yes, more and more easily.
And sometimes people say that there's more Cabernet Franc at Cheval Blanc because of the kind of soil. Do you find that to be true at VCC too, that the soil is determining the grape?
Yes, but we have to be very modest with Cabernet Franc. It can be the best and the worst. So Cab Franc is killed by an excess of warmth, of heat. It was nothing in 2009, for example, 2010 also. Both of them were our Merlot years. But at the opposite side, is excellent in very dry conditions. The last reference for good Cap Franc year is 2011. I remember 3 weeks, 1 month before the harvest, we were amazed by the vineyard is still green. It didn't have any drop of rain during 3 months almost. And this year especially, very good for Cap Franc. Cap Franc is stuck by an excess of heat, but excellent with late dry season. But which is funny is to realize that in 2015, we have excellent Merlots and also a very good Cabernet Franc, because global warming helped us to have a very, very good late season, in which helped Cabernet Franc to ripe until the end.
So the expression of Cabernet Franc is actually sometimes different now because of global warming, or at least the possibility is there.
The global warming helps us till now, but it has to stop at the right level now, not go further. It will be concerning. It is concerning. You see, Cab Franc in the blend is quite shy variety, but it gives to the blend the Kashmir side of the wine and overall the length. The Merlot gives you the base of the wine, is the structure, the tannins, the color. And you build your wine with some complexity, some length with Cabernet Franc, and you put the key of the blend with a little amount of Cabernet Franc, which is, as my analogist used to say, it's a line of lemon juice on a turbot. Because lemon juice in itself is quite simple, turbot itself is quite simple, but the line of lemon juice on turbot is much better.
And how do you see the actual site of VCC? I mean, how should I understand the vineyard as a whole?
The vineyard of VCC is in the middle of the plateau of Pomerol. Well, it's not so high, so it's quite flat, 33 meters high. And then is one piece, but three kind of soil, in fact. One mainly clay soil with all the Merlots. The other one is clay and gravel, the Cap Franc. And then the other one is only mainly gravelly soil. It's only the 5% Cabernet Sauvignon we had. And Cabernet Sauvignon just in front of Le Pin. Le Pin, at the opposite, if I may say, Le Pin is the opposite of Petrus, if you want, in a way of the soil are opposite. Petrus is mainly clay soils. Le Pin is mainly gravel, deep gravel. And Le Pin has its own Merlot, in fact, where normally a normal Pomerol would plant some Cabernet Sauvignon. That's the specificity of Le Pin, mainly.
That's interesting because they're so often compared. I think because they're so expensive, both. That's a comparison that's made a lot, Le Pin and
exactly.
Petrus. But you're saying the raw materials are actually very different.
But in a glass of wine, Petrus and Le Pin are completely opposite. Le Pin is Burgundy style, which is lighter and complex. Petrus is a bit slightly bigger. It's more a velvet style for Petrus. It's more silkier or maybe more Burgundy style for Le Pin.
And so what were some of the standout moments that you had at VCC? Were there vintages that were challenging that you learned from? Were there vintages where you felt you had been particularly successful? What were some of the real things that you remember looking back?
Well, to tell you the truth, I'm learning every day. A tricky year or a difficult year is much more interesting for me to do. You must be stupid or silly to miss 2010, for example, huh? Or everything is given by nature. But even if I say that, we have a lot of work to do. Even for 2010, for example, but no problem. An excellent year, which is quite challenging, and at the end, my God, so it's so good. For me, 2006, for example, which is no more average year, but a good, because we take a lot of risks at the time. Remember that, for example, 2006, we had, just right in the middle of the picking, we had two storms, one 40 millimeters, and the second one 12 hours after, of 60 millimeters, so 100 millimeters of water right in the middle of the picking for the Merlots. So what can you do? It was like a swimming pool everywhere. And the risk is an outbreak of rot, of course, but by dilution. So a young guy with no experience would double the team of workers and go straight in the vineyard and pick everything before the dilution and then rot expected. But because of the weather conditions and weather forecast, which are now more and more precise, which help a lot for quality, it was just an accident, just the two storms. And the next week was much better and without any rain. So I tried to jump from day until 10 days later. So, of course, we had an outbreak of rot, but we have now a sorting table of everything by hand. We sort the bunches in the vineyard and the berries in the cellar. So, at the end, we lost, of course, 1/4 of the yield, but the result in the glass is much better because all the different varieties were picked at the right moment, at the optimum ripeness.
It was a difficult vintage that you're proud of the quality of.
Yes, but because it belongs to one human decision. An example, in 2014, we stopped four times according to the weather forecast. The berries of 2015 were too young, too clean, were not old enough. You see, maturity is a kind of degenerescence. Huh? So the skins were too young. We need the fall coming. We need some thickness of the skins.
You want more thickness in the skins?
No, less. We had the lack of color, lack of tannins, so like the extractability was too low. So we had to delay the things. And there to have some rain, some storms. And so we stopped because the weather forecast at the opposite of normal, we stopped expecting the rain and then we restart after the rain. We tried to delay the things to have a good maturity of the skins because of the rain expected, which works very well.
And what about the addition of the GPS? I mean, what exactly does that allow you to do?
To improve quality, you need more precision. During my grandfather's time, for example, the vineyard was considered only by the varieties. During my father's time, inside the varieties, they picked the varieties by age. At my time, we decided to go a bit further, and inside the same plot at the same age, we prepared the kind of soil, the kind of topsoil. And then afterward, now it's about 8 to 10 years ago, I tried to fly over the vineyard before 3 days before the picking and make some photographs from above. My son did it, and I just part of it. And then we separate the greener parts from the less green parts. The greener the plant is, the more vigorous the plant is, and the less good is the wine, in fact. The more vegetal, the risk is the vegetal. So next step is to be a bit more precise, and you use GPS. But combined with computers, which put all together some analysis of the soil, some parameters of refraction, we made film of a canopy with infrared system. And so you can see exactly during a certain period of year the differences of the greenness of canopy, and so on and so on.
And have you done a lot of canopy work in general?
Yes, of course. And I think with the global warming, we will go back to ancient methods. The deleafing, for example, and the height of the canopy will be reduced because the alcohol is too high now.
Is that clonal as well?
The clonal and mast cell selection, they are both of them, they have their own positive thing. But for me, the clonal selection is much higher in the quality itself because it gives a more homogeneity of the plot. So it is ripe at the same moment. That's the main question. If you have a mast cell selection, complexity given by each different plant can be combined in a positive way, but it's much more challenging, much more. And it depends on the year. You can have the year for mast cell selection, which is much better for them, and another year, more difficult, it was the case for 2008. The complexity coming through 2008 is given by the mast cell selections.
And do you see other differences between your father's generation and your grandfather's generation and the methods that were being used and then what's happening for you now?
I think the comfort of working is a big, big positive thing for the result at the end. During my grandfather's era, it was quite difficult, very hard work. They use horses, for example. And it's not because the horses was in the vineyard that the wine was better. It was very hard to work at that time. I remember when I took over the property, we had to fight against the worker to put them on the tractor. And now I have to fight to put them out of the tractor because it is AC system and radio and all of things. But it's much more easy now. And the work itself is much better, much better. So everything is improved. The key word is optimization in viticulture, in the field. And in the cellar is selection. Selection, selection, selection.
So how is it varied now in the cellar?
The methods itself in the cellar hasn't changed in a global meaning. But one example, the temperature for the fermenting process is much lower than it used to be. We don't use less and less air to aerate during the process of fermenting just to prevent an excess of oxidization. We prefer to have a more reduced wine as a more oxidized. That's a new method, new way of thinking.
You think the reduction showcases the flavors nicely?
Exactly.
That's interesting. I don't hear a lot of people say that.
Because during the maturation process in cask, the presence of oxygen is quite high now. So, and with alcohol, I think the wine is more stable, but it's very sensitive to air.
So it's like a protective layer that it has while it's in cask if it starts reductive.
Exactly, and you use less sulfur also.
So it allows you to use less sulfur if it's reductive.
I'm not sure, but when I say that, we will see that in the next step.
It's a direction you're thinking about moving in.
Yeah. As the method used for more natural process in the vineyard and in the cellar is very, very positive.
What are you fermenting in?
Wooden tanks.
And that's somewhat unusual, right? I mean, I think a lot of people have gone to steel at some point.
Yes, but you see, it's not because of the vat is in wood or in stainless steel or in concrete that the wine is better or less good. The wood tanks is better in a way that is very insulated. So you can have, for cold weather, cold temperature is very, very useful. It's the opposite for a stainless steel vat, for example, which is it loses calories very quickly. So you have to bring them some calories, some heat. And the more neutral one is the concrete one. And for me, I think the concrete vats are the best, but they're not pretty.
So you fermented in wood, and then the mallow happens in barrel?
In the vats, you have the, what do you say, the must. The must is the juice, the pips, the pulp, and the skins. So it ferment, and then after 1 week and a half, you have the wine, the simple wine is made, and we rack after 3 weeks of vatting. And then the press wine, the first press wine is put immediately in a racking wine from the vat itself. And the second press is kept a bit beside. We decide to blend it with the wine afterward because we need to wait a bit.
It does seem like press wine is part of the style of VCC. Like when I taste it, I think, oh, this has some press wine inclusion.
Always. The two-thirds of the press is in there, yes. It's a kind of style, kind of decision. And afterward, the wine is set in a cask during for 18 to 22 months, depends on the year. And then we clarify the wine with white of eggs. And
which,
then,
is that still common? And do a lot of people still do that?
I think it's still common, but they can use it in stainless steel vats, for example. You can do it. And then we whip the wine in the bottle on the next May of the second year, the May in the second year.
So you've controlled the fermentation to make it lower, so the fermentation is taking longer than it may have in the past.
The length, the duration of the fermenting process is essentially, for me, is linked to the thickness of the wine. The lighter the wine is, the more flash is the fermenting process. The thicker the wine is, the longer it is.
And you're looking for a bit of a thicker style?
It's given by nature.
Right. What about the length of mallow?
Length of mallow, well, 1 week, 1 week and a half, or for the fermenting process. And Cap Franc, 1 week. Cabernet Sauvignon, the same as mallow. In fact, the Cabernet Sauvignon in the left bank has exactly the same role as the mallow in the right bank. It's the base of the wine in the left bank, and for Cabernet Sauvignon for left bank, and mallow for the right bank. But for us, Cabernet Sauvignon right bank is, as I said to you, the icing part of the cake, is the key of a blend. And it was used for us, VCC, as the ability of the wine for aging. Cabernet Sauvignon gives you more ability of wine to age, which is not sure.
And do those grape varieties show immediately their character in barrel, or does it take a while?
Immediately, even in a mass itself, before the fermenting process. A berry of Merlot is very good to eat, to taste. And a berry of Cabernet Franc is medium. And Cabernet Sauvignon, it has no taste compared with the Merlot berry. Cabernet Sauvignon is very surprising because the Cabernet Sauvignon expresses itself, its own character, sapidity, after the fermenting process. Seems to be a bit fade as a berry. Fade, pale, pale taste. Un goût simple taste. Very, very simple.
Because I've experienced that, actually. I've had Cabernet Sauvignon, and I've thought, oh, maybe it's not a good vineyard. But it doesn't seem that complex as a grape.
It is. We transform the taste of Cabernet Sauvignon in the fermenting process. Transform it. And all the first smell, the first taste with Cabernet Sauvignon, you just ferment it. It's like metamorphose.
At what point do you blend the different barrels together? How long do they stay apart?
They stay apart the entire winter. And we manage the decision of the blending at the end of February, beginning of March. We have 16 different batches, 16 different origin, about 8 Merlots, 4 Cap Franc, and the rest Cabernet Sauvignon. And then we decide to make the first wine to be the best wine as possible for the next 10 years. And then this is the first step. The second step, in between the different batches, which are not obviously first wine, they put all together, and we see what's going on. And then some of them can be second wine, some of them can be reintroduced in first wine. And then at the third step, we see which is the potential first wine, which is 8 times after 10, after tasting, something wrong is in it. And you have to tune the things from 2 to 3% of one of the components to have the famous balance, which is the key of a balance.
And when did you introduce the second wine?
I started in 85, and I started with second wine, with the crop thinning, and also reducing the yield of the property.
So immediately you had some ideas about some changes you wanted to make.
Yes.
And those were influenced by some of the historical examples of VCC that you had tasted?
Yes. 61, for example, is the example of the crop thinning. Because they had Easter 61, they had the spring frost. It reduced by 30% the yield, and the result in the glass, it was much better than the previous year, which was 60. And 62, by the way, was a big, big yield, because the plant, it accumulates a lot of reserves and restarts a new yield, twice normal yield. So that's why 62 is a good wine, but diluted by an excess of yield.
And what do you see forward? What is the future path for VCC in terms of continuing evolution, meeting the conditions?
As I said to you, I think it's optimization, the keyword, so this is no end. I do hope so. That's the interesting of the kind of job I do. And which I remember when I started, the people said, oh my God, they made such a good wine in the 30s or in the 40s and 50s. And the wine was much better before now.
That's not a very nice thing to say, is it?
Yes.
Did that piss you off? Did you get mad about that?
Yeah. And to tell you the truth, the wines now are much better than they used to do. They used to be. Of course. If I had to, I compare 2010 with 1950. And then today, I think if I had to remake a 1950, for example, it would be much better than now. Right? That it used to be.
Yes. With those raw materials.
Yeah, exactly.
So what's the origin of the pink capsule for VCC? Because it's rather unusual. Like on the bottle, it's pink.
Yes. This is my grandfather's decision in 1924 when he started there. He was quite, my grandfather was a bit, we say in French, original. And so during the 20s, pink color was very fashionable. It was the shocking pink in Paris with Schiaparelli. And so he dared to put some pink color on the capsule. And then at the end, it was, as a result, when the bottle is lying, you can see exactly where VCC is. But it was only for me, because my grandfather was a bit eccentric.
To be a little unique in the market.
Exactly. It's a bit shocking.
And you saw the origins of Le Pin. How is it different than VCC?
First of all, Le Pin is mostly a gravelly soil. That's the most important. And then Le Pin is 100% Merlot, which is different from VCC. And also Le Pin is a patchwork of different age of plantation. And also Le Pin, at the end, in a glass of Le Pin, it's also a selection. All the production is not Le Pin. There is an unofficial second wine of Le Pin.
Oh, there's a second wine for Le Pin. So yes, you taste through the barrels and you say
Exactly, yes. The Le Pin is always a selection with the best cask of Le Pin made a certain year. But the second wine is made up with the 3 years of second wine all put together.
So it's a blend of three different vintages. To maybe give what the previous vintage had not, the characteristics.
Exactly. Yeah. The specificity of Le Pin is mainly the tiny, tiny vineyard, very small, and I can put the name of each different plant. And you see, I'm working a very, very high standard vineyard. The answer of the vineyard is like a horse, a race horse. And the answer is very, very rapid, very, very fast. And for Le Pin itself, it's so tiny, so small, there's no room for mistake, if I may say. So it's quite challenging. And the success of Le Pin is the kind of wine produced at Le Pin is so soft, so easy to reach in one hand, and in the other hand, very complex. You have the both faces of the kind of wine. So Le Pin, for me, is condemned to stay small. If he increases size, he will lose his own specificity. It's exactly if you put with your thumb a stamp on the map of Pomerol, just below, under the stamp, you have the famous little plot of a deep gravel, and combined with a water table quite high during the winter time. So all everything combined, you have a very specificity, which at the end, consider Le Pin for me as a part of a blend kept separate. Le Pin is a pure Merlot on gravelly soil with associated with this very high water table, very specific, and then it can be considered as a part of a blend kept separate.
So in many ways, Le Pin is sort of a flip side of VCC. It's sort of like the opposite.
They are complementary, of course.
Le Pin became famous quite rapidly, whereas VCC had a reputation and had been established for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Did the sense of it being something kind of new change the perception? Because, I think with VCC, you said it's annoying to you when people say that it used to be better, but that probably didn't happen with Le Pen. There was probably no such kind of conversation. So I wonder if that affected how you saw the wines.
No, this doesn't affect me at all, because I consider the wine as wine. With all the issues behind it, it doesn't matter for me. You see, we are surrounded by a lot of cynicism, huh? And cynicism is, the definition is knowing the price of everything and the real value of nothing. And I try to stay in front of a vine of Le Pen, of VCC, and I know them, they are very valuable, and I'm very lucky to work for them. So for me, it's wine only, and a real, true value. That's the most important for me.
What do you think that is for Le Pen? If I were to understand the true value of it, because the valuation in the market is...
To tell you the truth, it was quite long for me to admit that Le Pen was a very high quality wine.
I got that sense, yeah. That was the sense I got.
Exactly. And at the end, and especially for 98, for example, quite long. And when I taste 1998 by cask, one of them was very, very, very good. It was the wine of unexpected. Everything was there. It was a Burgundian style. And my God, what a wine. But it disappeared because it was blend, of course. And I had some this kind of experience afterward, 2001, excellent wine. A big bag, 1986, excellent. Le Pen can match the certain years, not every year, but certain years can be outstanding for me, stunning for me, and my own taste.
Did your measuring standards have to change a little bit coming from the lens of VCC? Did you have to think about it differently? I mean, did you find that part of it growing on you is that you embraced it more?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to admit, but I think, yes, everything is improving. Huh? Everything counts. No?
One of the things that Le Pen is very famous for is malolactic in barrel.
Mm.
Right? I mean, I think that's one of the things that was sort of noted early on.
Yes, but it was said. But to tell you the truth also, is just because we didn't have enough room to put the wine in a cask, in a vat, to make the malolactic process. So the wine was racked from the vat to the cask. And by the way, the malolactic process was made in a cask.
So like they do in Burgundy, but that wasn't common in Bordeaux.
No. But during the 50s, for example, even at VCC, because of the big yield they had at the time, or during the 60s, turnover in the vat room was much faster. So sometimes they decide to release the wine from the vat after the end, largely before the fermenting process, and refill it. And of course, the wine was set in the cask, and the malolactic was made in the cask at the time.
So for you, it was a situation of necessity.
Yeah, exactly. It's much more necessity than proposed, yeah.
But then how did it end up that's different than doing it not in cask? Like, what does that mean?
For the very first year, it can change. But at the end of the first year, for a wine made, which has made his malolactic process in the vat or in a cask, you don't see the difference after 1 year.
So ultimately, they hit the same spot.
Exactly.
With time.
Exactly. But in certain way, it can show a sample for the imprimatur tasting a bit more attractive. If you made it in a malolactic process in the cask.
Some people wrote about it, and then that became a very standard practice, right?
Of course, yes, a lot of people. Now the method is used for a lot of different of properties, yes, to do it in a cask, malolactic process, of course.
So when you approach a bottle of Le Pen and a bottle of VCC, when do you like to approach them? What is the aging curve that appeals to you? You said that you sort of make VCC to be wonderful for 10 years. But when does that mean you open it at 10 years, or when do you start to pull the corks?
8 to 10 years is necessary for VCC to reach a normal approach.
That's the beginning.
Yes,
really.
Yes. And for Le Pen, I think not so far the same.
So you can actually handle them similarly.
Yeah. You see, the aging ability is given by the amount of tannins present in the wine. And you can have a pure Merlot or a blend Merlot Caprin as the same level of tannin. The aging and the maturation of the wine is exactly the same as it is Merlot, pure Merlot or a blend wine. Doesn't matter.
How multifaceted is Merlot in different sites? I mean, how many expressions could there be? Is it a grape like Riesling that really expresses the site very differently each time? Or is it a little more limited? Or is it in between those two things?
For me, a little bit limited.
Yeah, has certain expressions.
Yeah, exactly.
A handful, maybe.
Exactly. Riesling is can be very versatile, different. And you can guess before you open the bottle what kind of perfume or aroma of parameters you have in your glass. It's always surprising, Riesling. And for Merlot, it's always... Merlot is Merlot, and Cabernet is Cabernet. Sauvignon also.
Has the experience of making Le Pin affected how you view VCC? Have you brought back different eyes from that experience?
I think it's the opposite. VCC brought a lot of back to Le Pin.
And going forward,
yes,
what would make you happy at each property? What would be a delight?
That the next generation make the same kind of wine, doesn't be influenced by the taste of different fashion, or and keep going in the right track and be obsessed by quality.
Alexander Tempo and Francois Tempo have kept going inside the family Tempo on the right bank of Bordeaux with wonderful wines on multiple generations. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Merci.
Alexander Tempo and Francois Tempo of Vieux Château Sertan and also Le Pin and also Wings. I've got something pretty unique to tell you about. Coming up on the night of April 23rd in New York City, there's going to be a really incredible pairing of Jura wine and the Jurassic Park movie. It's going to be lots and lots of Jura wine, all the different iterations like Mac Van, Cremant, Vignon, Etois, and all of that and more from excellent producers, poured along some tasty food, and get this, because this is a pretty fabulous part, there will be lots of costumed Jurassic Park folks there, including dinosaurs, scientists, and quite a few Jeff Goldblums. Yep, that's right, it's a costume party. A serious wine tasting and a serious costume party. Should be pretty amazing. There will be a guest sommelier roster pouring at an open bar. There will be trivia questions. There will be a real live visiting geologist, not a costume standing, but an actual geologist. And there will be a Jeff Goldblum impersonation contest with magnum-sized prizes awarded, maybe to those of you who haven't forgotten their mantras. Sounds like a good time, right? Yeah, that's what I thought. Dinosaurs, wine, food, I mean, what else do you need, really? That's a good combination. Well, what you do need are tickets. Tickets are $125 starting April 1st, and you can purchase them for this event at jura.brownpapertickets.com. That's Jura, J-U-R-A, .brownpapertickets.com. This party will start at 10 p.m. on April 23rd at a secret location in Lower Manhattan that will be divulged only to ticket holders. That's right, secret location. Secret's pretty cool, right? Well, I'm going to go ahead and make it this whole thing even cooler for you because I got a surprise for you. I've got two tickets for this event that might have your name on them. Yep, two free tickets for the Jura Jurassic Park tasting on April 23rd, and they can be yours. That's like getting $250 for free. But even better is that you're getting $250 worth of wine and cool costumes, some free tickets to a great wine party. Who doesn't love that? All you have to do is leave a nice iTunes comment about this show. Yep, that's it. Leave a nice iTunes comment about the show and include in there some way to get a hold of you, like an email address. I will pick a winner for the tickets from the comments, and if that's you, you'll get the tickets. It's that simple. I'm going to read the comments posted between April 1st and April 18th. I'm going to see who has something nice to say about the show on iTunes, and I'm going to randomly pick a winner from those comments on iTunes on April 18th. So you've got until April 18th to leave an iTunes comment about the show and get a chance for two free tickets for some fun in Lower Manhattan on April 23rd with Jura wine and Jurassic Park costumes. Do it! Get in there. You'll be happy about this. Jeff Goldblum will be happy about this. And dinosaurs will be really, really happy because, you know, frankly, dinosaurs, obviously, always very happy, right? Right! Get those tickets. Post a comment on iTunes. Leave a way in there for us to get in touch with you, and we'll enter you in the party sweepstakes. Before we finish up this episode, we have some people to thank. A big thank you to the amazing Alder Yarrow and his website, vinography.com, where you can find write-ups and warm-ups for the show, as well as other exceptional content. A huge thank you also to Drew Hendricks and James Tidwell of Texom, who made a generous and really game-changing donation of new equipment to this show. You can check out texsom.com, that's T-E-X-S-O-M.com, to see what they're up to in their own endeavor. It's always a pleasure also to be involved with Crush Wine and Spirits in Manhattan, with whom we have a wine club for regularly discounted offers on wines that we feature on this show. You can write to me directly at levyopenswine@gmail.com to find out how you can join in on our wine club. And also our thanks to you, the audience. Together, we get to really sit down and learn about wine one person at a time. You can let us know what you think on our Facebook page, or by following us on Twitter at DrinkToThatPod. You can also check out pictures on Instagram at LevyOpensWine, that's me, or you can leave a comment and a review in iTunes. We love iTunes comments. They go a long way to help us out, too. Also, if you haven't subscribed to the show yet on iTunes, you should go ahead and hit that up. iTunes subscribers see new episodes in their feed before non-subscribers, and often new episodes arrive several hours or even days earlier for subscribers. And we actually have an episode right now that doesn't even show to non-subscribers. You literally have to subscribe to see it in your feed. It's been weeks. If you want to listen to the newest episode of the show, and also if you want to listen to back episodes from when we first got started, the easiest way to do so is to subscribe in iTunes. Our website is alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com with no apostrophe in the ill. And you can find information there about buying a t-shirt to wear around so you can show your support, or also about how to donate to the show. There's some back episode listings on the website as well. We'll see you again next episode, and cheers.